From the late 1960s to the early 1990s, the United States saw an unprecedented surge in serial killing, rooted not just in the dynamic changes of the post-war period, but in the development of the human psyche going back many millennia to our ancient past. Wonder why serial killers exist, why they emerge, and why they exploded in the post-war United States? Check out The Golden Age of Murder, a panoramic look at serial killing focusing on the United States in the post-war period with your hosts, Toby and Simeon.
You're listening to The Murder in My Family, brought to you by Abject Entertainment. Be sure to check out some of the other great true crime podcasts from this network, including Missing Persons, DNA ID, Beyond Bizarre True Crime, Zodiac Speaking, and Scene of the Crime. All of these podcasts are available for you to binge on right now, wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe where you're listening to this podcast so you don't miss an episode.
The views and opinions expressed by guests on this podcast do not necessarily represent those of the podcast, its host, or sponsors.
If you would like to discuss the murder in your family on this podcast, please be sure to visit themurderinmyfamily.com for more information.
You can support this podcast by visiting patreon.com/themurderinmyfamily. This episode may contain unsettling material or subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Thank you for joining me for this episode of The Murder of My Family. I'm your host, Mike Morford. In this episode, we'll be discussing the case of a 25-year-old single mother of two who was viciously stabbed to death in her Comanche, Oklahoma home in June 1988. She suffered over 24 wounds, which seemed to indicate a crime of passion. But with three ex-husbands and a boyfriend, there was no shortage of potential suspects for investigators to dig through. We'll dive into this case after some quick housekeeping. Independent podcasts like this one depend on word of mouth to bring in new listeners. So if you find that you enjoy this show, please take a minute to rate and review it wherever you listen to your podcast. And be sure to introduce a friend to the show and invite them to listen. With your help, The Murder of My Family can continue to grow and reach a new audience. To learn more about the show or the cases we discuss, please visit themurderofmyfamily.com. You can also find us on Twitter with the handle @murderofmyfam. Or by searching for the Murder of My Family podcast on Facebook. If you'd like to support this show through a Patreon donation, it's always appreciated, and you can do so by visiting patreon.com/themurderofmyfamily. Benefits of supporting the show on Patreon include early access to ad-free episodes of the show, plus bonus content not heard in regular episodes. Support may also include thank you cards, stickers, and more. If you prefer to, you can also support the show through a PayPal donation by visiting paypal.me/themurderofmyfamily. In each episode, I'll give shout-outs to any new supporters. And thank you to all the supporters that generously donate to help keep the show growing and improving. One last note. Please consider supporting any of the sponsors that you hear on The Murder of My Family, the way that those sponsors support the show. It's with our sponsor support that the show can go on, and continue to provide a platform to share these stories with you in every episode. Thank you, and now on with the show. Mary Morgan was born on February 22, 1963, in Lubbock, Texas, to David and Elizabeth Morgan. She married Ricky Tidwell in July of 1979 when she was just 16 years old. The marriage lasted only 1 year, ending in divorce, but not before it led to the birth of Mary's daughter, Kyra. Mary found love again and married Tim Allen in August 1980. He adopted Kyra as a baby, and he and Mary had a daughter together, Amber, soon after. Things were tough for Mary, and she divorced Tim Allen in 1986, after a turbulent relationship. With two daughters, Mary was determined to find love once again and provide a stable environment for Kyra and Amber. She married a man named Stan Pewitt, but things didn't work out between them either, and they began preparations for divorce. Mary was facing the reality of three divorces by the time she was in her mid-20s. but she had learned from those marriages that she was strong and that she didn't need to rely on a man to support her and the girls. Mary settled into a home in Comanche, Oklahoma, located at 611 North 10th Street. She began dating a man named Randy Benson, but after three failed marriages, Mary was in no hurry to get into a serious relationship, and instead planned to focus on her girls and her work. Mary was a nurse at a nursing home, but was injured at work. After suffering the injury, she was unable to perform the task for her job and was left partially disabled, despite several surgeries to try and help her. Wanting to provide for Kyra and Amber, Mary took a job as a server at Harold's Club, the only bar in Comanche at the time. The new job required Kyra to work sometimes late into the night. When she had to work late, her mom Elizabeth watched the girls, usually having them sleep over at her house. And that's exactly what happened on Friday, June 3rd, 1988. It was Mary's 13th day working at Harold's, and she had to work late. So Kyra and Amber spent the night at their grandmother's house. Elizabeth had something to do early the next morning, so at 6 a.m. she brought the girls home. She knocked on the door and didn't get a response from Mary. Six-year-old Amber, being the smallest, climbed up on a flower planter to look into the window of her mom's bedroom, perhaps thinking she'd see her mom snoring away after a long night at work. What she saw was something she'd never forget. She cried out that her mom was lying on the bed, covered in blood. Elizabeth scooped up her granddaughters and ran to a neighbor's house to call police. When first responders arrived, it was clear that there was no helping Mary. She was dead, and blood was everywhere. It was later established that Mary had been stabbed over 24 times, with some reports saying 27 and others saying 30 or even more. What was clear was that Mary had died at the hands of someone in a frenzied attack. Although Mary was clad in just her socks and a large t-shirt, there was no evidence of sexual assault. It appeared that part of the attack happened while she was laying down on her waterbed. She put up a fight against her attacker based on defensive wounds on her arms and hands, but sadly, couldn't fend off her killer. A search of the house didn't reveal anything of interest, although police did notice that one of the doors to the home didn't lock. In fact, it had been rigged with bungee cords to secure it and keep it shut. Police wondered if the killer had entered through this unlocked door. They also had to consider whether Mary knew her killer and let them inside. The brutality of Mary's murder pointed in many ways to it being a crime of passion. Most of the injuries focused on Mary's chest and neck area. Police determined that the killer attacked Mary between the time she got home from the bar and when her mom and daughters got to the house. Based on this, she must have been attacked between 12:45 a.m. and 6 a.m. on June 4th. Harold's Club closed at midnight, and after her shift was over, police verified that she took receipts and the day's earnings straight over to her boss's house. Mary's boyfriend, Randy Benson, first said that he was with her when she stopped by her boss's house, but then later he changed up his story, claiming that he went to Mary's house after she had stopped at her boss's. The changes in Randy's story caught the attention of police. Regardless of whether Randy was in the car with Mary when she went to her boss's house, or he came over to Mary's house later, he didn't deny being with her after she got off work. Randy said that he was with her in the home and left after spending about an hour watching TV. He claimed he wanted to get home in order to play video games with his son. This would have been after 1:30 a.m. If Benson's story is true and accurate, this would mean that Mary was killed between 1:30 a.m. and 6 a.m. But the changes in Benson's story, as well as his claim of wanting to play games with his son after 1:30 a.m., didn't sit well with police, and Randy Benson remained on their radar as a possible suspect in his girlfriend's murder. Police also looked at the other men in Mary's life. Mary and her third husband, Stan Pewitt, were in the process of a divorce, so he seemed to be a logical suspect. The only problem? Stan couldn't have attacked and killed Mary that morning, because he was in jail in connection with stealing property from Mary's mom, Elizabeth, so he seemed to have an airtight alibi. It was determined that Ricky Tidwell, Mary's first husband, had been out of town when the murder happened, so he too seemed to be in the clear. Tim Allen, Mary's second husband, had remarried, and he along with his new wife were looked at because they had fought with Mary months earlier, and during a different fight around the same time, Mary had allegedly stabbed Tim in the hand. The relationship between Tim Allen and Mary was volatile, and they were not on good terms, much of it centering around Mary's daughters. Tim and his wife denied any involvement and were each other's alibi for the night of Mary's murder. Police didn't stop with people close to Mary. Male patrons of Harold's Club were questioned as well. They felt that perhaps one of these patrons interpreted Mary's politeness as interest in them, and perhaps one of them could have possibly followed her home that night after she got off work, leading to her murder. But no one was arrested, and the case went cold. In 2014, Mary's family decided to raise money for a reward, hoping that it would finally motivate someone to come forward after all that time. Still, 7 years after that effort, there were no leads. It's not for lack of effort on her family's part, though. Mary's father, David Morgan, earned a degree in criminal justice in order to be able to investigate his daughter's case, and Mary's daughters, now adults with kids of their own, advocate for their mom's case, hoping to see it solved. In 2019, Mary's picture and a brief description of what happened to her was added to the playing cards issued to prisoners in Oklahoma, hoping that someone in the system would have information come forward, but no one did. The answer to who murdered Mary Morgan Pewitt may be found in evidence collected from her crime scene. It's believed that unidentified prints and DNA from Mary's killer were recovered there, but it's unclear what investigators are doing with this evidence in an effort to ID the killer. Most recently, in February of 2022, the OSBI sought to identify two women who lived in Duncan, Oklahoma in relation to Mary's case, but they added that they were not suspects, and since then they haven't released any more information about these women. Was Mary Morgan Pewitt killed in a crime of passion at the hands of one of the men in her life? Did a patron at the bar Mary worked at become infatuated with her and followed her home where she rebuffed his advances? Or did an opportunistic criminal in Comanche randomly enter through Mary's unsecured back door to commit a burglary and was confronted by Mary, who he killed in a panic? There's no shortage of possibilities in this case, only a shortage of answers. And it's frustrated police and Mary's family for over three decades. Mary Morgan Pewitt's murder has now gone unsolved for 34 years and is one of over 400 cold cases in Oklahoma. She now has grandchildren who will never get to meet her. June 4th is now recognized as Justice for Mary Morgan Day in Comanche, Oklahoma. If you have any knowledge about the murder of Mary Morgan Pewitt, you're encouraged to contact the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation by calling them at 800-522-8017. You can also email them at tips@osbi.ok.gov, and you can remain anonymous. I sat down with Mary's daughter, Kyra, to discuss her mom's tragic murder so many years ago and how it's affected her family as she searches for justice. That conversation is coming up in just a moment. Hey everyone, I want to talk to you about our sponsor, Feels, the best CBD shipped directly to your door hassle-free. It's a better way to feel better, and by feel better, I mean it helps to relieve and reduce stress, anxiety, pain, and sleeplessness without the dangers of hangover or addiction. You may be familiar with CBD, but for those of you who aren't, CBD is an abbreviation for cannabidiol. It's one of over 113 active compounds that are naturally occurring in hemp plants. CBD has no psychoactive properties, and CBD is the second most abundant cannabinoid found in cannabis, just behind THC. Cannabis with less than 0.3% THC is now classified as hemp. Instead of being rich in THC, CBD is usually the most abundant cannabinoid. CBD is often touted as a non-psychotropic, meaning it won't produce a high or affect our motor functions, in a way a high THC strain of cannabis might. And you may begin to feel the relief it provides within 30 to 45 minutes of taking it. Feels is made up of two ingredients, U.S.-grown full-spectrum hemp and 100% USDA organic MCT oil. Feels is so easy to take. Simply place a few drops of Feels under your tongue and feel the difference within minutes. I've been taking Feels to help with joint pain in my knees and legs. And as an added bonus, it helps me sleep well at night. If you need a dose of chill on the go, pop one of Feel's new CBD-infused mints for a clear-headed feeling and fresh breath. The thing to remember about CBD is that finding your right dose is important, and everyone's dose is different. In fact, Feel's offers a free CBD hotline to help guide your personal experience so that you find your perfect dose. Join the Feel's community to get Feel's delivered to your door every month. You'll save money on every order, and you can pause or cancel anytime. Start feeling better with Feel's. Become a member today by going to feels.com/family, and you'll get 50% off your first order with free shipping. That's feals.com/family to become a member to get 50% automatically taken off your first order with free shipping. feals.com/family. Hi, Carver, and thanks for coming on the Murder My Family to discuss your mom, Mary's case with us.
Thanks for the invitation.
Well, it's my pleasure to have you on and hopefully bring attention to your mom's case. It's still unresolved, and I'd like nothing more than to see you get some kind of answers. Your mom's case is frustrating, obviously, because it's still unsolved and what you went through. But one of the sad things that I found about it was that it was you and your little sister, Amber, along with your grandmother, Elizabeth, who found your mom's body. I can't imagine what kind of scarring that's left on you and your sister. And I also imagine that was pretty tough for you and your sister, but your grandmother. How did you all get past that initial, you know, just finding your mom like that? How difficult was it to get on past that and, you know, move to where, as you're growing up, do you still have that memory? Is it something that's sort of etched in your mind?
We really didn't have a chance to adapt, I guess, so to speak, or to figure out what the new normal was. It was just all of a sudden we had a new stepmom. We're supposed to call her mom and go on with our life. We weren't allowed to talk about my mom. It was pretty much, even I have a third sister. And when she came along, we were told to tell her mother had died of cancer. So we never really got to deal with it until we became adults.
Yeah. And you were just what, 7 and your sister was 6 when this happened in 1988. Okay.
Yes.
I guess one thing I wanted to ask you about, what jumped out to me, your mom looked like an actress named Meg Foster, who was in a lot of films in the 1970s and 1980s. She was an attractive woman. She was outgoing. Do you think your mom might have had maybe some unwanted attention from the wrong person? Maybe someone.
She always had attention from people. But I'm not sure that I don't personally think that is what led to this happening. I think it was very personal.
And that's something we're definitely going to get into, because there is a very personal aspect to this. Before we get into all that, if you would, can you tell us a little bit about your mom and just what your memories of her are, or what people have told you about her? Because you were still pretty young at the time, and I'm sure some of the stuff you've learned about your mom was after the fact. Can you just help us get to know your mom a little bit, who she was?
Sure. She was born in Lubbock, Texas. Her dad, her biological father, went out of the picture when she was about 4 years old, and she lost touch with her paternal side. My grandma raised her on her own for probably about 2 or 3 years. And she met David Morgan, who adopted my mom. As a teenager, she was, my grandma always said she knew what buttons to push, to get what she wanted. And, you know, all she had to do was pretty much smile. And my grandpa was putty in her hands. And, 15, she decided she wanted to get married. And they didn't allow her to marry one boy because he was from the wrong side of the tracks, but they allowed her to marry another boy. And she got married. That lasted less than a year. Out of that, I am a product of that. And then roughly a couple months after their marriage ended, she married Tim Allen. And they were married roughly 5 years, and Amber is a product of that relationship. So she never really was without a significant other, I will say that, which I think, being older now than she was, I think it would have been, in hindsight, I think she would have, once she got out of that, she would have been able to realize that she could do things on her own and she didn't need a male companion always. And then the last husband was Stan, and he was several years older than her. And a drunk. When my mom did pass away, he was incarcerated from theft from my grandparents. She was going through a divorce with him at the time she passed away. And she had recently been in a relationship with a man named Randy Benson for about 3 months prior to her passing away. She'd always worked in the nursing home that was catty corner from our house. And my grandma worked there as well. And she had a patient that fell on her. She had back surgery that February of 88, which left her to the point of not being able to lift any more patients. And she started working at Harold's Club, the local bar. And she had been there roughly maybe 2 weeks when she passed away. But to me and Amber, she was mom. She was the person that liked being outside. She loved growing plants. My sister and I joke about how Amber got part of her. She can keep plants alive outside. I can only keep them alive inside. So we have the best of both worlds. I remember making snow ice cream with her. That's something I try to do with my daughter now, but in Texas, it's a little hard when you don't get snow often. And I just remember the way she smelt. It was like Carmex because she never wore lipstick. But she was a friend to everyone, but she was always the rooter of the underdog.
So it sounds like you have, despite the passage of time and you being young at the time, you do hold on to certain memories that you've been able to keep.
Yes.
Wow. And that's good to hear, because I know a lot of times when you're talking about an old case like this and a child that's pretty young, a lot of times they don't remember anything, but it's good to know that you do have some pretty vivid memories of her. I want to talk about the time around the time leading up to her murder. She had just started this job. You mentioned it. And obviously when you're younger, I'm sure a lot of times your parents won't necessarily talk with you about what's going on with their work stuff. But over the years since then, did she talk to anyone else that has relayed it to you since of what your mom's impression was of this new job, and if she liked the people there? Did she have any issues, any problems working there those couple of weeks that she was there?
I've not heard any, because you hear lots of things after this happens, but that's one of the things I've not really heard anything about. We do know that, you know, that evening she went and turned in the receipt after it closed. And we were kind of told that that's where, you know, just the local bar, there was not another bar in Comanche. It catered to everyone, the locals, the roughnecks, the, you know, and everybody in between.
So it's sort of a melting pot area of people that would come.
Absolutely.
Let's go back to that morning, June 4th, 1988. You had spent the night with your grandmother, I assume because your mom was working that night late into the morning, and so it made sense for you to stay there, and then your grandmother was going to drop you off in the morning. Can you walk us through, based on your memory, what happened that morning, what you saw, and sort of how things played out?
Sure. I have snippets, I guess. But we left my grandma's house. They lived about 20 miles outside of town in the country. And my grandma was trying to rush us out the door because she had a meeting in Oklahoma City for Weight Watchers. And we got in the car like normal, pull up in the driveway. For whatever reason, I'm kind of stuck in slow motion opening that door. I don't know why, but that's how it plays out in my head. And we all got out and went knock on the door. There's no response. My mom's room was the room in the front of the house, and it had windows on two sides of her room. And one of the windows had a planter that you could actually climb up on top of. And I remember just being in the driveway and Amber climbing up there. And I don't remember what was said. I know my grandma has said in an interview that Amber said she's all covered in blood. My grandma couldn't get through the front door, so she went to the side of the door. We just know, or we know because of her talking to us later on, but that she went in there and that she fell to my mom's stomach. And, you know, she's later on saying that she's still warm. To me, none of that ever even happened. It's just, I'm stuck in that driveway. And she comes out hysterical and she runs us across the street. And before we knew it, we were just taken away from there.
So it's all a blur. It unfolded quickly. And I can't even imagine, your grandmother finding her daughter there in this condition. Your mom, it just must have been unbelievable. And I wonder if there's some kind of, in your mind, there's some kind of coping mechanism that sort of blocks out what happened after the driveway. Do you ever look back and say, maybe my mind is just trying to protect me and not let me see what happened after being in that driveway?
Absolutely. Because I've been asked, from law enforcement, do you remember what happened here? Does this sound familiar? And I can't see that as much as I've tried to, or as much as I've tried to force myself to.
Yeah. And one thing I am curious about, you mentioned, you just said how your grandmother couldn't get in. I read that one of the doors didn't shut properly or didn't lock properly, and that there was some kind of bungee cord or something like that on there to secure the door. Was that sort of tied shut and wouldn't allow your grandmother to get in? And was that normal for that door to not be accessible?
Actually, it's quite the opposite. The front door or the main door was locked with like a deadbolt, and the side door, I don't even know how or why or anything, but it didn't have a doorknob in it. So it's just literally a hole, and my mom would bungee it from that to the chair just so it would stay closed. So all somebody had to do was take the little bungee out of the hole, and they were in the house.
Okay. So it wasn't really to secure it and keep it locked. It was just to keep the door from flying wide open and
pretty much.
Okay. And obviously anyone that knew that about the house would know they could come in there easily, or even someone looking to rob the house might've just stumbled upon that door and was able to get in one way or the other.
Correct.
And I'm curious, and again, I'm sure at the time you didn't know this, but now if you know at least what the police theory is of how the person came and went from the house, do you know which way they came in and out?
I think there's a theory that it's probably that side door.
Okay. And I am curious too, and this, I guess, goes back to your grandmother having difficulty getting in. So the front door was deadbolted. So that was, no way to get in. Was that typically normal for that door to be deadbolted?
Yes.
Okay.
We had like a little entry. So it was a screen door. You walked in, I guess it'd be kind of like a little mud room. And then there was a heavy door that was always deadbolted when we were home.
So that was pretty usual. And did your grandmother try that door that was typically bungeed that day? And was it still bungeed?
That's where she went second, but she went to the front door first, just because it was closer access to where we were at.
Okay. And I'm curious, when she tried to get in where that door was secured with the bungee cord, if it was connected like it always was, or did it seem like somebody didn't connect it when your grandmother entered there?
I have no idea.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm curious to see if someone took the time, if they went in and out of that door, if they would have bungeed it back when they left. That's interesting. So again, I know this is all so long ago. You're young. Some of this you probably blocked out. I'm curious, what do you remember of when the police arrived and they're sort of milling around the house and the property? Do you remember certain things of what they were talking about or asking you about?
Actually, we were taken completely from that scene. I want to say that our grandfather on Amber's side came to pick us up. And I want to say he got there almost as quick as the police did. And we didn't see any of that.
So you sort of missed that aftermath of what was going on at the house.
We did.
Okay. Do you recall your grandmother over the, you know, in the aftermath telling you at some point what was said or what they asked about, those kinds of things?
Yes. My mom's cousin, which would be my grandma's brother's kids, she called them and she said on the phone, "Mary's dead." And he said, "Well, what do you mean?" And she could never get past just saying Mary's dead. And so they drove from Fort Worth, Texas to Oklahoma, and they stayed parked in the driveway with my grandma and my grandpa. And my understanding is from talking to them is that my grandma just wanted to get back in the house to see her one last time. And they, you know, just kept kind of pushing her off and, you know, no, you know, it's not going to happen. And, but it just never sunk in. And then when the medical examiner's office got there, pretty much she collapsed when they wheeled her body out. But she had just been wanting to see her one more time.
Yeah, so she was like probably in shock and grieving mm-hmm. and stuff. And obviously the police aren't going to let someone into a crime scene like that. So that must have been really right. difficult for your grandmother to deal with. I'm curious too, in the aftermath of all this, the police do their investigation. What did your family tell you as a child? You know, how did they handle, because obviously you want to know what happened to your mom and could you even comprehend at the time that she was gone? How did they handle all of that with you and your sisters?
I want to say it was, again, time is so different when you're little, but I want to say it was roughly 2 days after the fact. Not my grandparents on my mom's side, but on the other side, we were all gathered at that grandfather's house and told, you know, do girls understand that your mom is gone? And I just remember it being like, yeah, we know. You know, why did it take you 2 days to tell us? But I mean, I just remember thinking, we already know this. And we left with my grandfather and his female friend, Sharon. And Sharon has told me later on in life that, I guess, Amber asked, where are they going to take her? And I responded, either to the morgue or to the hospital. And she said she just remembers that being just so crazy that somebody so little could understand what was going on.
Wow. And yeah, just to have that kind of, you know, thought, you know, instead of being devastated and upset and everything, you're still sort of clearly thinking in your young mind at the time to say that, because you sort of knew where that would, the options were. Yeah, it's amazing the young child's mind and going through something like this, how you sort of compartmentalize certain aspects of it, but then you're also clearly thinking about the things like that where you can provide an answer sort of like that.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about the crime itself. It seems like a crime of passion. Your mom was stabbed, 27 times, I think it was. Very brutal. So a crime of passion could indicate someone obviously close to her. And we'll get into more of that. Of course, you know, could she have attracted unwanted attention from someone at the bar? Could it have been an intruder that randomly came into the house since it didn't lock? I mean, those are also possibilities, but I think on the surface, a lot of people would agree that it seems like a crime of passion. So obviously, looking at that route, you know, the police became very interested in your mom's relationships. And your mom had been married, as you mentioned, 3 times. I sort of wanted to talk about those relationships. And the first was Ricky Tidwell, right? Your father?
Yes.
Okay. Your mom married him in June 1979. I think she was, 16? You mentioned the relationship didn't last long. Now, is it correct that he was out of town when your mom was murdered? That pretty much rule him out right away, do you think?
My understanding is he was out of the state, but that is all I've ever been told.
Okay. Did your mom have at the time any kind of relationship with him? Did you have any relationship? Were you guys talking or did he stay in touch at all?
Ironically enough, probably within the last month prior to her passing away is when I had found out he was my father. And he had started to come get me for maybe about an hour. We'd go get ice cream and kind of really try to figure each other out and get to know each other. But that had just started happening probably about a month before she passed away.
Okay. So your mom was definitely communicating with him. Do you know if everything was civil between the two of them, as far as you know?
We saw lots of domestic stuff, so that was never really hidden from us, but it wasn't with him.
Okay. And let's talk about your mom's second husband. This was Tim Allen. He married your mom in August 1980. He adopted you, and then they had your sister. And their relationship ended in 1986, and this was after your mom had suffered abuse at his hands. Is that right?
Yes, and as much as I want to say it was just his fault, my mom and I guess are a lot alike in that effect, that she never would cower away from a situation, and she was very much full in on these altercations. And I'm not saying it's one person's fault or another, but there was no retreating or backing away from the situation.
And was there a relationship sort of volatile? Was there a lot of, maybe physical stuff or arguing, fighting, that kind of stuff?
All the time. The one memory that plays out in my head is I had a little music box that was of Winnie the Pooh. And I remember it getting busted. And that the song Winnie the Pooh still continued to play. But that was the day that, you know, he'd come home drunk. She was upset. She'd been home with 2 girls all day. And I think she actually broke his nose with a paint can in their fight. And we're just sitting there listening to Winnie the Pooh and watching this.
And that's sort of, it sounds like that's sort of it in your mind after all this time. You can still clearly remember that.
Yep. Snippets are so clear. And then other parts, it's like what happened next.
And their relationship ended in 1986, and I guess your mom had enough of the abuse with him. I'm curious, after the breakup, did they stay in touch? Did your mom communicate with him, and on so what level?
Sure. They were going through a divorce, and it seemed pretty much that their volatile relationship continued through that, and that He wanted custody of us on the weekends. Pretty much any time they saw each other, there was either verbal abuse back and forth or physical abuse. But they were also fighting over a settlement that Tim was to be granted, that he was awarded, they didn't know the dollar amount, but was awarded during, while they were married. And so she was entitled to half of it when they separated. That settlement happened late summer of 1988.
Okay. And I'm curious, looking back now with everything you know and everything you've been told, was Tim looked at and clear? Did he have any kind of alibi at the, as far as you know?
Living with him up until, you know, high school and everything else, I have never been told where they were that night. They have never talked to us about it. They were not available to pick us up that morning, which is why his dad is the one that picked us up from the scene. And they spoke he spoke briefly to the police right after it happened. And his new wife told him to get out of the car. They had the criminal defense attorney on the phone.
So they lured up pretty quickly, it sounds like.
Yep. Yes.
Okay. And then your mom's third husband, was his name was Stan, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And what was Stan's last name?
Pewitt.
Okay. How long were he and your mom married?
They were still married. They were going through a divorce, but they were still technically married when she passed away. But I want to say it was roughly not quite 2 years.
Okay. And do you know how the relationship between them was? Was it sort of amicable, the breakup, or were there any, was there any friction or bad blood?
There
between
was some
them?
Friction. I would say he's, when I think of the word obsessed, that would be pretty much him. I mean, he would write her letters and, you know, that if they were, if nobody, if she couldn't be with him, nobody was going to have her. And, you know, the summer prior, my mom had ended their relationship and we had been at my mom's friend's house and he actually came to get Amber and I to quote unquote, go get ice cream. As being a little kid, you don't know any different. And we got in his Bronco, and that Bronco ride lasted for 3 hours to go to Irving, Texas from Oklahoma. And we were held in Irving, Texas by him for 3 days. And just a bad situation, because he wanted her to get back with him and he thought by us being there, that would help. And it didn't. She had already kind of figured out and made up her mind that she didn't want to be with him.
So that's a bad situation when you're taking kids to another area without. Okay. Now, am I correct that he was actually in jail at the time of your mom's murder?
He was.
Okay. And this was because he had stolen money from your grandma, did you say?
I want to say it was like things. I don't want to say it was money. I want to say like he had stolen, you know, different things out from their property and stuff.
Okay. Did the police pretty much say, okay, he's in jail. He has nothing to do with it. They, as far as you know, did they rule him right out because he was in jail at the time?
Yes.
Okay. And so there was another relationship and she's going through this, this divorce with Stan, but then she starts another relationship. And what was the new relationship she started and how long was she in that relationship?
It was the same with Randy Benson. And I want to say it was roughly 3 months. But it was different than any of the previous month or any of the previous relationships that we had seen. He just seemed to be kind of quiet, and you know, it was more of us spending time watching TV together. And when he was there around us, they weren't living together or anything like that. But I would just want to, it was more like a subdued relationship that she'd had compared to the others.
So did it seem a little bit more, smooth as far as no physical altercations or any of that kind of stuff? Okay.
Yeah.
Did you think your mom was happy in that relationship without that kind of stuff going on in the background?
I want to say yes, but I think in a way that she kind of fed off of the excitement of, or the energy of the other relationship. I think she had also kind of gotten to a point where my grandparents had bought her the house that we lived in, that she knew she didn't have to physically or mentally depend upon someone to pay her bills anymore. And so I think it kind of gave her an upper hand in that relationship, and that it wasn't something that could be held over her head. And so it was more of because she chose to have the relationship.
Sure, that makes sense. So it was a little bit of a different type of relationship than she had had leading up to that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, as far as Randy Benson, do you know if he had any kind of alibi? Was he cooperative with police as far as you know?
At the time, you know, you hear all kinds of things. We were told that he did speak to the police. There was some, you know, someone has told me that, you know, they grueled him for 6 hours, which I know now that that's not accurate. And his alibi was that he followed my mom from the bar, that they'd been in the bar together that night, either back to her house or followed her as she delivered the receipts and money from the night to the house. And he says that he spent until 12:30 with her because he had to be back home to play video games with his son at 1 o'clock in the morning.
And how, I'm out of curious, how old was his son? Do you know?
I know now. I didn't at the time. His son would have been 11 or 12.
Okay. I mean, I'm trying to think about, you know, comparing my kids playing video games late in the night or early in the morning, I should say. But I guess you could, depending on the kid and the parent, you could say maybe that's something that happens. But it seems a little bit unusual that he's going back at that time to play video games. But did his, I understand it, if I've interpreted everything correctly, that his story changed a little bit here and there. Do you know, can you elaborate on that?
It has. It's gone from, you know, we know that no matter what, she left at 12 o'clock from that bar. And distance wise, she turned in those receipts, and to go home would have taken at least 15 minutes. And so that puts her at home at 12:15. If she didn't stop to get gas or, you know, anything else. And he says, so basically he spent 15 minutes with her. That 15 minutes has become, you know, yeah, I left at 12:30. I had to be with my son at 1, 2. No, I had to be back with my son at 12, and that she got off a little early. So the time has changed quite a bit from roughly 11 to 1.
That's quite a big difference as far as that timing. Now, was he cooperative other than his story changing? Do you know if he was cooperative with police? Did they administer any kind of a lie detector test, anything like that?
He did not take a lie detector test. I don't know if it's because he elected not to or if they didn't ask.
So here we are. It's 34 years later, your mom's case is still unsolved. you've got what seems like a crime of passion. As far as the investigation, do you know where it stands now? Do you know if police are still actively working it? Do they have anything to work with, such as DNA, prints, any of that stuff, as far as you know?
Up until roughly a year ago, it had been one of those cases that was put on a shelf. And when my grandpa passed away, my mom's adopted dad, I promised that I would do everything in my power to see this through, because he had retired from Halliburton, actually went back and got a criminal justice degree to try to figure it out. And even up until his dying day, he wanted to know what happened. And it had just sat on a shelf, you know, different from either Comanche Police Department to Stevens County Highway Patrol to eventually the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation was called in roughly 9 years after the fact. Knowing what I know now, I don't feel like there was ever a full lot of I's or T's checked, lot of I's dotted and T's checked. I think they zeroed in on two people that were just local bad guys, which I think have pretty much been ruled out at this point in time because they have cooperated over the years and taken a lie detector test. But it was easier to blame somebody like that. And so within the last year, the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation has opened a cold case unit. My mom's was picked one of two within the region of Oklahoma that this happened in. And we have been assigned an agent. His name is Joe Kimmons, and he's amazing. we had lots of different opinions in the beginning because they can't tell you a whole lot and you want to know a whole lot. But I know without a doubt it's moved further in the last year than it ever has.
Well, that's good to hear, because a lot of times cases, the older they get, the less movement they have. But to know that they're taking a fresh look with fresh eyes has got to be encouraging for you.
Absolutely.
And obviously that doesn't replace or make up for any shortcomings in the investigation early on. Just looking back, you mentioned they sort of locked in on the local bad guys. Were there areas where, looking back, you think they made mistakes not looking at different things or going down certain avenues in your mind?
I don't believe that Mr. Benson's alibi was ever verified.
And from my own.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say, and you mentioned his alibi not being checked out. I'm assuming this alibi would be his son that he supposedly was playing video games with, and maybe his ex. Would she have been with the son at the time?
He was actually supposed to have gone. He lived with his mother. And so the son would have been with grandma while Randy was gone.
Okay. So a couple different people that would have to verify his alibi, and you don't know that was done properly.
I do not know that was done at all.
Okay. Which he should have been on a short list for sure. He's obviously was in a relationship with your mom at the time. So most cases like this, the police will start with the people closest to the victim and then work their way out from there, looking outwards. Where here it sounds like maybe they locked into some local bad guys and really didn't go with the people closest to your mom.
Absolutely.
Out of the relationships we talked about, your mom's husbands or ex-husbands, in your mind, again, you can share what you feel open to sharing. Do you feel that any of the men she was married to could be involved, or do you think in your mind that they had nothing to do with this?
I think that it is, maybe not necessarily who she might have been married to, but in a relationship with, just the fact that there's a lot of unanswered questions, such as an alibi not being verified. And also even, you know, the relationship with Tim and how volatile it was, them constantly fighting over child support, you know, his new wife pretty much hated my mother. You know, she had stabbed him 2 weeks before in our house with an ice pick. So that relationship was always and still volatile. And just the fact that they've never sat down to answer questions, to me, it just says, you know, do you have something to hide and why won't you answer?
Yeah. You mentioned earlier they lawyered up pretty early on too, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So unfortunately here, there's a lot of relationships that seem to have trouble connected to them. You know, history of abuse, alibis that don't check out. There's a lot of avenues to go down for investigators in this case. I think that's, unfortunately makes it a little harder for them to come to a conclusion. I'm curious what you think, just again, in your mind, knowing this case, what you've learned over there, what would you like to see done at this point now that can be done?
I think the people that have never answered questions, if they don't have anything to hide, should step forward and just answer, because they may be the little piece to the puzzle that we need to, you know, find the next piece. You know, if you've been asked to take a DNA test here recently, that, you know, to cooperate and to do it, because they, you know, at the time in 1988, no one knew about DNA or anything else. You know, there was stuff left behind. And I believe one day that will be what proves or doesn't prove this case.
Yeah. And I didn't see it when I was researching. And I don't know if you even know, or if maybe just there was none of this. But I'm curious, is there any evidence of either your mom being sexually assaulted or the home being burglarized? Any of that you know of?
Sure. The house, nothing was taken out of the house. She, according to the medical examiner and the autopsy report, she was not sexually assaulted. But she was found in a t-shirt and bobby socks and nothing else.
So it could be something, and I maybe you can remember how your mom would typically, would she sleep in something like that? And maybe someone came in and in the middle of the night and attacked her? Or what do you think when you hear about her being dressed that way? Was that what comes to your mind?
No, and you know, at 16, nobody would tell me anything. So I ordered the autopsy report for myself. And so I have this mental picture of this drawing and this crop top on a drawing. And so it wasn't even a long shirt to cover her bottom or anything else. And my mom would have never walked around without underwear on and a crop top on. It just, that wasn't something she did.
Okay. And do you think that's a sign in your mind that maybe she was with somebody in some kind of intimate encounter, something went wrong?
I think that's a possibility.
Yeah. And unfortunately it's just, the people you mentioned that might have some answers that aren't talking or aren't fully cooperative. Or is everyone in your mom's past still alive?
Randy Benson has passed away. Stan Pewitt passed away as of May of this year. Tim and Lynn are still alive. And her first husband, Ricky Tidwell, is still alive.
Okay. So there are still people that can answer questions or give more information. And then even if someone's deceased, their DNA, can some, you know, in some cases be still compared to any that they might have in the case. Correct. And have they said publicly whether they have a profile or anything along those lines?
I know that they are waiting on some things. Okay. I don't want to step too far down that road. But there is stuff to be compared.
Sure. Does it give you hope seeing all these cases solved that are 20, 30, 40 years old? Do you still hold out hope that your mom's case is going to be solved?
I have more hope in this last year than I have ever had before. Just with technology, the communication that we have with the OSBI. I just think that if it's ever going to happen, it'll be this year or next year.
Oh, let's hope. And you never know, because there could be someone out there that's going to hear this podcast, for example, and say, hey, I knew so-and-so back then, and I heard this, and you never know, someone might come forward with a little piece of information that helps solve the case. That's why I think it's important to keep talking about these cases and hope that someone hears, and, you know, maybe they say, that person that I was afraid of, that I heard information about, now isn't around anymore. I can come forward without any kind of fear. So hopefully somebody comes forward with some information that does lead to your mom's case being solved.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Yeah. I think it really puts things into perspective that your mom's been gone for, what, a decade longer than she was actually alive for, you know, being... 25 when she died. What have you and your sister lost out on without your mom in your lives? And how has losing her so early on affected both of your lives in the long term?
Sure. My sister physically looks like my mom. Personality, I've been told I'm pretty much a spitting image of my mom. It was hard for me as a kid because I don't have the I'm just going to conform personality that my little sister either learned to manage or to create to make life easier for her. But with my step parents, I was sent off and to live with different people to be brought back home. I mean, I went through 17 different schools before finishing high school. And it was never having stability. And I think the one thing that we miss more than anything is both of us are moms to, I have a little girl, Amber has three girls, just them knowing my mom. They didn't really get to know my grandparents either, just because, you know, they were born pretty close to the time they were passing, and that they don't really have a clear representation of my mom's side of family and who she was and, you know, the silly things that she got into and just that part. You know, my daughter, she didn't understand what a grandma was when they had grandparents' day at school. And I never in a million years thought I would have to explain what a grandparent was. And that was rough.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people maybe don't understand too the ripple effect of something like this, you know, obviously your mom's life is taken, but then it changes the course of not just your life, but even your children's lives when something like this happens.
Absolutely.
Hmm. Well, one thing I did want to ask is, because I know listeners will probably be curious to see how everything went with you, because, you know, losing your mom was one thing, but then you had new challenges. You mentioned going to 17 different schools. What happened to you and your sister after your mom died? Did you go to live with your grandmother? And if so, what kind of adjustment was there moving from one life with your mom to this new life?
We actually went to live with Tim and Lynn. It pretty much started immediately, after my mom passed. Within a year, we moved from Oklahoma to Texas, to where we knew no one. And my grandparents were amazing in the fact that no matter who they thought or what they thought, they always came and got us every other weekend. So we got to spend time with them. But, you know, being brought up and not being able to talk about your mom and being told, you know, that pretty much pretend like that didn't exist. Even my little sister didn't know until she was 13 years old that how my mom died. You know, we'd been told to lie to her and tell her that she passed away of cancer. So I want to say that, you know, between after my mom passing and, you know, our through high school, it was rough for both of us. You know, I was off living somewhere else and Amber was trying to adapt to survive in the situation she was in. But I want to say once we were able to have normal relationships outside of home, we're pretty functioning adults.
Yeah. All things considered, that's, again, I don't think anyone can imagine what that must be like for you, having to live through something like this and go on and still have those memories all these years later. It's got to weigh on you, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Well, I hope, again, somehow, some way that investigators do make some progress and you're able to find out who did this. And hopefully they can be accountable, but I'm sure if they can, if they're dead or whatever, that at least giving you an answer might help you in some way. So I hope you do get that kind of outcome.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for coming on to share your mom's story with us. And anyone out there listening, please, if you have any information, if you heard anything, if you have any kind of tips, please call them in to the authorities and hopefully you can help put this to rest.
Thank you once again for joining me for this episode of The Murder of My Family. I'd like to thank Sonny Landon for writing and research assistance in this episode. As we wrap up, I'd like to play a preview for a true crime podcast.
It's called Reverie True Crime.
Be sure to give it a listen. We'll be back here soon with an all-new episode of The Murder of My Family, and I hope you'll join me for it. But before you go, remember that every murder victim means something to somebody.
Reverie, the state of being pleasantly lost in one's thoughts. A daydream. But what if those daydreams turn to nightmares? Reverie True Crime shines a light on the dark tragedies that have happened and are continuing to happen all throughout the world. We interview and work with families to bring awareness to forms of injustice. We explore the depths of cases from around the world to include missing persons, mysteries, and more. Reverie True Crime is found wherever you're listening to this podcast. Remember, you don't have to live in fear, but stay aware of your surroundings. Stay safe and take care.